Michael, can you share for the people listening there an important aspect which you've been demonstrating throughout, which is skill with things like conversation submodalities with the meta model framing tool and some of the other language models of NLP in terms of, say, the Milton model. That, like, one of the common themes that I've heard many times is people say they've gone on a course, a hypnosis course, for example, or they've studied Ericksonian hypnosis. They've even memorized the language patterns, but yet they say that they can't induce trance intentionally and conversationally. How can people make sure that if they've already invested a lot of time acquiring skills, making a couple of key shifts will enable them to get the ball on the road, so to speak?
Boy, that's a presupposition. That is a major presupposition in there. Okay. I would argue, and this is, I'm going to be a little provocative here. I would argue that most of the training that people take in hypnosis is not in how to use trance in order to affect change, but it's in techniques and rituals that have been created at various points historically and that are used as part of the ritual act of hypnotherapy, trance work, or whatever. But what is not taught is what the trance is for and how the change occurs and what the strategies are that have to be engaged. It's rather like taking people through procedures for learning how to paint. You know, first you pick up the brush, and there's several ways you can pick up the brush. You can pick it up this way. You can pick it up that way. Now, start with an azure blue paint. Pick up the paint on the end of the brush, place it onto the canvas, etc., etc. What do we call that, by the way, when you have a procedure to make a painting? What do we call that? Paint by numbers. Yeah? Those things that you had when you were a kid where they give you the blank sheet or the blank canvas and it has the numbers in all the places and you just stick the colors into the right place. It's a great exercise in pattern matching, but I wouldn't necessarily call it art. In order to make the leap, you have to get beyond the procedure in how to translate an intention and a perception and put it into form using the tools that you have. So what I would say is if people have gotten over-focused on this notion of language patterns and techniques, et cetera, they've missed a huge, huge trick because within the, for example, the Milton model and the work that Bandel and Grinder did on Erickson, they looked at one part of his skill set, but not his clinical nous. They didn't look at how he made decisions and what the schema was for making decisions around diagnosis, et cetera, et cetera. But then again, some of the Ericksonians who were with Erickson, they took his work and, you know, Mr. Rossi, God bless him, he was an Ericksonian. Sorry, he was a Jungian by theoretical framework. And so he kind of transliterated Erickson and put him into a pseudo-psychodynamic framework. Each of those people who studied with him took it in a slightly different direction, but they didn't capture what Erickson did. They captured what you could say about Erickson looking from a particular perspective. In terms of cool stuff for studying Erickson, I think Bill O'Hanlon did some of the coolest things around his patterns of intervention. Bandler and Grinder, hands down, of course, did in terms of the language and the structure of the trances and stories, hands down, best work. But for the intervention side of things, I thought Bill O'Hanlon did some really interesting stuff. The book Taproots, some of the pattern interventions that he noticed with Erickson, I thought that work was very interesting. Took apart some of the types of interventions that Erickson did and looked at them purely from the point of view of what changed. So from Taproots, you can get an idea of the kinds of things that one might do with the stories in the trance state. But you have to acquire some familiarity and knowledge of how change occurs. I tell people who come on the business practitioners and on my master practitioners, the people to study are the ones who make change happen naturally, spontaneously, who JFDI. You don't want to study the people who had to go to therapy for years and years in order to make some small change. As you go around the world, you'll meet lots of people, you'll find their stories. When you meet someone who, you know, made a big change in their lifestyle, they, whatever it was they did, those are the ones you want to talk to. And they will give you information about what has to happen in order for change on whatever the scale is to occur. Without that knowledge of how change happens, and without that knowledge of what people do when they're doing well, it's going to be tricky. It's going to be tricky. It's probably one of the reasons why people try and stick with scripts and paint by numbers, because they simply don't have the information. They'd rather take a shot with something that worked for somebody at some point rather than figuring it out for themselves. I understand that. I understand. I argue that there is more than enough information and examples of effective change that happens spontaneously and naturally all around us. All you have to do is just start talking with people and asking questions, and you will discover the ways in which people make change easy and the ways in which they make change difficult. Some of that from my own process and talking with people and finding out. Some of that went into the Platinum Audience Club.
So let's share, Michael, some of the, well, there are many different protocols for inducing trance, but in a conversational trance sense, given that probably a lot of people listening may not have at least an intentional awareness of I'm looking to create a trance, but doing it conversationally without any hypnotic voice in the traditional sense, without following a script and all of that. Can you share some useful protocols?
Yeah, sure. Protocol, it's that damned word again. Yeah, as if there is a procedure to follow and then the procedure generates the change. It doesn't. The techniques are not the change. In many cases, whether we're talking about hypnosis or we're talking about NLP, the formalized techniques are not how you do it. They're how you learn. I'll give you a couple of possibilities here. One of the most common things that gets in people's way is that when they reach the edge of possibility from the point of view of their map or model, if they have a couple of examples, usually it's between one and three examples, of not being able to achieve something or not being able to find a way through, they'll say something like, it's not possible for me, I can't do that. They generalize from specific examples up to it's not possible. Furthermore, they might say something like, and this happens it's so frequently, it's ridiculous. They'll say things like, not only is it not possible, they'll say, I tried everything. And if you inquire, you find out that they tried one, two, or three things. What's happening there is that people's maps are impoverished, that they've got a strong limitation, that on the basis of what they've experienced, they have everything that they need to know in order to be able to make the judgment. So through that map impoverishment, it tells you, A, first of all, that what has to be added are resources that come from outside of the mapper model. What that means are references or examples or possibilities that they can't see given the unique qualities of their way of thinking. So within conversation, and of course, by the way, all of this fits within the framework. I'm just going to make sure for people who haven't either been on the Platinum Audience Club or haven't studied NLP, it always takes place within the context of knowing exactly what the desired state is and where someone is in relation to that and what resources are required in order to get them to change that present state, to do something different so that their present state changes into that desired state. You need that information first. You're not just going and throwing stuff out and, you know, throwing things at the wall and hoping something sticks. So in having that conversation about what they tried, the first resource that needs to be added is not stuff that I know or stuff that I've seen other people do, the first resource that we have to address and deal with is their certainty. The problem is they are too damn certain about what it is they don't know. So that state of certainty that they're in is the one that we have to work on, so that there is a possibility within their thinking that they may not have gotten everything, or that what they say is only true given very specific situations, conditions, etc. So I can start talking about, you sound fairly convinced. And I'll pick an analogy. I'll pick a story. What was Erickson's favorite technique? Do you know what Erickson's favorite technique was?
My friend John.
Everybody who's even read a little bit about Ericksonian hypnosis knows about my friend John. What do we call my friend John? My friend John is anecdote. I knew somebody once, and then tell the story about someone kind of like you, actually just like you. And in the story goes the information about they were wrong. Now, I'm not saying, by the way, I never tell people that they're wrong or that they could be wrong. I mean, from a totally objective and godlike perspective, like, for example, like Mary Poppins, I am practically perfect in every way, always perfectly rational, and always right, as are you. I mean, you've never thought something was going to be really hard, and so you put it off, and you put it off, and you put it off. And then once you eventually did it, you discovered it was really easy. You ever done that? Yeah. I think everybody has. It's one of those things that it's kind of like, the Olympic stack of dishes when I was at university. We had this game where we would get every single dish in the house dirty, and it would all be stacked up in the sink. And we tried everything in order to get people to wash the damn dishes. But by the time the Olympic stack had emerged, it just seemed like a bridge too far, a mission impossible, a just too huge a task. But when eventually I needed some stuff and I just said, to hell with it, I'm just going to get on with it and do it. As soon as I started in, I was able to clear all of the dishes and all of the pots and pans and everything, and it took 15 minutes. It was one of those things that I thought it was going to take hours. So the conversation carries on, and we talk, and we exchange information. And the conversation, maybe, 5 minutes in, suddenly the person is saying, well, actually, it's not that it's impossible to do this, it's just that I get so down when I try hard and I don't get the result. I say, oh, okay. And then I find another example, another my friend John. But this time, when I tell them my friend John, rather than it being some sort of just an anecdote, it's now a narrative. And the narrative is expressly contemplated in order to create a state of something for them to enter into and for them to imagine. Have you ever heard somebody talk and imagine what they said? Have you ever done that, Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the time.
All the time. It's not something that you have to go to university to study. It's how we exchange information about our lives. So I'm telling a story and an anecdote, but now, rather than it being just some incident, it's now a proper narrative. It's now a story that's got a beginning, middle, and end. And as that story goes on, the way that I'm holding the other person with my eyes, the way that I'm talking with them, and the way that I'm gesturing, much more focused. I'm using a smaller space with my hands. I'm drawing their attention in. Yeah? Very straightforward. They may at a certain point even begin to develop trance behaviors, like they might defocus a little bit. That's where it's as if the focus of their eyes is inside rather than outside. The rate of breathing begins to change. If it was quick, it tends to slow down. If it was slow, it might move up into the upper part of the chest. At first, they may nod a lot in that social sign thing that people do, nodding their head. And that will start to change. That will start to settle down. They might blink more. They might blink less. It's not important or relevant whether their eyes close or not. What's important is that reduction of focus from many things down to one. Then I can start offering ideas in this slightly disassociated way, because I'm not talking about them and I'm not talking about me. I'm telling the stories. And then in those stories, there will be sequences within them that have submodality information. Like, for example, if at first when you're telling a story, you're setting the scene just like in a film, where you're describing the things in the environment, you're describing the area, the cars that are here, the color of the car, this, you're giving big picture information. And then as the story goes on, you can focus it down quite a bit. If you want to, you can even bring it right down into trancy kind of submodalities, right down to, you know, talking about being at lunch in this really lovely place, and I was having this conversation with somebody, and a beam of light just hit the glass at just the right angle. And this tiny little beam of light just went through it. So I'm changing my tone, I'm changing the focus of the imagery that I'm evoking. And as that happens, the person relaxes and calms down and enters that focused state. I can then tell the stories and then ask them a question and get them to participate. And more often than not, what happens is that they respond to the state that they were just in. They change perspective, they change frame of reference, perhaps the meaning for whatever the issue or challenge that they were talking about changes. But it's come about because we're having this conversation, and in that conversation, the stories have a process that allows for change. It happens quickly. We're talking minutes. We're not talking hours. You can go in and out from it as well. You can pick it up. You can shut it down. If you're in a restaurant, you're going to be interrupted. But you just pick up where you left off. And through the natural processes of anchoring, if your story was good enough and your state was inviting enough and focused enough, and you made yourself listenable and made yourself followable, then they will go with you.
Powerful. It's very different, Michael, from the formal process. I think for a lot of people listening in and just seeing some of the questions coming in, it's a shift from thinking again in procedural-based approach to actually this is the most natural thing in the world and it's happening all the time. It is happening all the time. Yeah.
See, all right, now let's address the question of specificity, because it's important that people understand that this isn't about vague language. I've seen so much written about Ericksonian hypnosis that seems to suggest that it's vague and ambiguous language put into a procedure. What I'm talking about is very, very different. You use the conversational approach not so that you can be vague and give, they call them non-specific function tasks. You know, somebody tried to solve a problem once, so they decided to go for a walk around the block, et cetera, that kind of thing. That's not what I'm talking about. You use these processes in order to create very specific sequences in people's minds, right? You can do it right down to the submodality level. But you're doing it in such a way that it is through a more normal, a more ordinary, a more human, relational approach than one person being the hypno-doer to another person. It's exactly the same thing that happens when you're having a conversation with somebody and you're having an exchange of ideas, and something that they say triggers off something in your mind, and then you offer something back to them, and it triggers it off in their mind. It's just that we have removed the unnecessary ritual and made it you know, essentially, you can have these conversations anywhere and at any time. But again, it all comes down to what's the desired state, where are they, what are the resources, and what is the strategy that needs to be instantiated, created, in order for the person to make the change easily. Remember, we're always looking, and this is another thing around interventions and intervention design. Our brains work perfectly well. We really are, by evolution or by design, doesn't matter. Our brains work really well. If you can get it so that whatever change, whatever idea you're putting in there, has an obvious quality to it. In other words, that it's not just a good thing to do. It's not just that it's the right thing to do, but that it's like a really great thing to do, and I'd be an idiot not to do it. You call that getting it so that the ball rolls downhill. You get it so that the ball rolls downhill, you're not going to have to do any arm-twisting hypno stuff. But that comes down to the quality of your thinking with the tool set, and then how well you can interact with others while you're using the tools.